This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
On the next episode of NeuroEmergent, I talk with Leah Blankenship, founder of the Neurodiversity Alliance at the University of Oregon. Go Ducks!
One thing I hear from so many of my ADHD students all the time is, like, if I hear one more person tell me to buy a planner, I'm just going to lose my mind because it just doesn't work.
I'm your host, Carrie Stewart Lingle. Join us at 11 a.m. Wednesday, August 27th, for a conversation about neurodiversity from a Gen Z perspective.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Today's show looks at the Epstein case and conspiracy thinking, at fascism and resistance, at the usefulness of borders to capitalism, and at some long-standing injustices of the U.S. immigration system. None of these topics or our approach to them is likely to endear us to the source of executive orders or to be covered by the big money media outlets. If you value KBOO, please support the station with a one-time or, better still, a monthly sustaining donation. On the website at kboo.fm or on the mobile app, you can click on the red Donate tab to help support and sustain independent media. On today's show, we hear from Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker with a Left in the Law segment about the dynamics of the Jeffrey Epstein case, its similarities and differences from other conspiracies promoted on the far right, and how the left should be thinking about Trump's frantic efforts to free himself of the ghost of Epstein. Where right-wing conspiracy theorists suggest that child abuse and sex trafficking is exotic and alien, the work of outsiders against whom a strong man will take revenge, leftists can recognize that the problems are systemic, that patriarchy and capitalism rely on exploitation and abuse as part of their ongoing injustice. That doesn't mean there aren't dangerous and misleading stories shaping our world, quite the reverse. For some comments on parallels and divergences in how the wealthy and the workers are addressing our poly crisis, I'll share a summary and excerpts of Naomi Klein and Astra Taylor's April essay on The Rise of End Times Fascism. Among other things, they note the ways that MAGA masses have been invited to imagine the nation itself as an armed bunker. Then we'll hear about how that hardening of national borders serves capital by undermining worker solidarity. Ivan Turi-Zarin explains the uses of borders for capitalism in a talk from an event held last month by the group Solidarity about the origins and problems of the anti-migrant panic. Finally, we'll revisit a conversation from the Oldmole archives in which Yasmin Nair talks with Denise Morris about the movement to refer to immigrants as undocumented instead of illegal, and how the movement for that more genteel term may have served to minimize and justify the actions of the neoliberal state. That's worth thinking about as we consider the ways that neoliberalism set us up for the current turn to fascism and where we need to go for effective opposition. All that's coming up on today's Old Mole Variety Hour. As ever, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments on our website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can also find a link to subscribe to our show, and you can click on the red donate tab in the upper right corner to help support local independent media. We turn now to our Left and the Law segment on conspiracy thinking and the Epstein case. Here's Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker.
Earlier this month, the New York Times published a trove of photos and birthday greetings to Jeffrey Epstein, the deceased and disgraced sexual predator and former best buddy of Donald Trump. In one letter, former Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, and his wife wrote, quote, "You are like a closed book to many of them, but you know everything about everyone," they wrote, describing Epstein as, this is all in caps, "a collector of people." Well, Epstein was most definitely a collector of people. The question of what people he collected and what he knew about them continues to generate 24/7 news and podcast speculation. Mike, let's start with the case of Epstein before taking up the conspiracies and cover-ups surrounding him that have caused such distress for the Trump administration. What's your sense of both the case from a legal standpoint? What is a conspiracy from a legal standpoint? And then your assessment of the charges against him?
Well, let's begin where a few people have lingered lately, which is Epstein's actual role in global capitalism. There's really nothing original about it. His main job was as a fixer for CEOs, for corporations, for investors, for administrators who could engineer a tax avoidance schemes, which could be unbelievably lucrative. And the key to his wealth was his work for financial manager Leon Black and Victoria's Secret boss Les Wexner. And the role of a fixer, most favorably played by George Clooney in a very good movie, Michael Clayton, is one that's essential in almost every corridor of power in states and in the federal government. What he helped them with was to avoid taxes. Then he protected his own income by becoming a resident of the Virgin Islands in 1996. In that same year, he bought Little James Island. And with this wealth he made and his skills, he accumulated ruling class connections that made him even wealthier. He acquired Johnson & Johnson heiress Elizabeth Johnson as a client, became close friends with billionaire Glenn Dubin, whose hedge fund paid him $15 million for introducing the firm to J.P. Morgan Chase, a bank. He became friends with Bill Clinton, with lawyer Alan Dershowitz, with former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, with Prince Andrews, and of course, Donald Trump.
But, you know, a lot of the sexual interest in this and the excitement generated, the libidinal life of the story of Epstein and the question of Trump's closeness to him involves his sexual interest in and exploitation of young women and girls.
But that was his commodity. That was his currency.
That was his currency. And in many ways, he himself seemed to be the primary erotic object in his world. I mean, there are countless stories of how people found him so seductive, so charming, how he would gather all of these people, intellectuals. Chomsky apparently visited his estate, you know, of a wide variety of people that felt he had a certain cultural capital as well as financial capital that was clearly part of, I think, an affinity with Trump. Trump has some unique talents in many ways. He's a very limited human being and has certain moves and relies heavily on them, but also has a kind of charismatic charm that you can see he found a fellow fixer, a fellow grifter.
But Epstein had skills. He had skills. His sex trafficking was used to attract clients. They said if you invested with him, well, he would get you laid. He would keep clients. He would get administrative and legislative favors. He would get favors from banks. He would use sexual favors more adroitly and more extensively than almost anybody else. It's not an unusual favor. It's used for corrupt purposes, just as there are acts of integrity. These things happen every day. The use of sexual favors is something that happens in every state house in this country.
And girls and women are the currency in many of these spheres of wealth and influence.
That's right. Sometimes they will get you where cold cash will not. So really effective fixers will have this in their arsenal. But Epstein developed it far beyond anybody else and became, I think, it's like a sorcerer's apprentice. He had a power that he could extend, and he did not know how to stop extending it, and he continued to extend it incrementally in every imaginable direction, and some that are yet to probably be imagined.
So perhaps Trump was correct in a sense when he chastised his followers for being interested in this case after he had decided there was nothing there to see after decades of pumping these kinds of conspiracy theories about the deep state and elites. But he cast the whole Epstein case as boring, said this, this guy's dead. Of course, dead people figure prominently in conspiracy theories. But perhaps the exposure of Trump through these files is not so much sexual as the kinds of transactional part of the world of the powerful and wealthy that you're describing. In a sense, there's a kind of more banal story, less exciting than the sexual ones that have grabbed hold of the fantasies and interests of so many.
Well, this is boring only in the sense that if you think the workings of global capitalism are boring instead of depraved, because it is very common what he did. The world that Trump moved within was a world in which Epstein was very dexterous, and he was just another player. He was a very effective manipulator of money. This is what happened within his world. But I don't think it's a world at all. But one thing conspiracy theories do is distract people from considering how our system truly works. And like Ron Wyden, in his investigation, noted that Epstein lacked any professional training or certifications in accounting or tax law, yet was chosen by very wealthy people to execute very complex tax-related financial transactions. Despite this glaring lack of qualifications that might lead anyone to double-check Epstein's work, it appears that the IRS failed over the course of many years to ever audit major transactions involving Epstein. So that's how someone without any training was able to obtain big clients, because he could enable them to have accepted as valid completely fraudulent maneuvers.
So there is, in that sense, evidence of a conspiracy of some sort, that there have been many people covering the tracks of this guy over time. And there seems to be an investment, if we don't call it the deep state, there's some deep investment somewhere in covering up the collection of people and their activities, that of which, you know, where he was kind of the central actor in many ways. So how do you separate the conspiracy here from the conspiracy theories that have been elaborated beyond what we know?
Well, what's very interesting is how did all this get conflated with Pizzagate, with satanic theories of infant sexual abuse, theories that really echo theories that reigned in Paris, France, before the French Revolution in the 1770s and 1780s, about the higher-ups and elites like Marie Antoinette and all her friends committing just depraved acts on tiny children. There were broadsheets, the French equivalent of blogs. There were people perpetuating horrible, scandalous rumors that echo almost precisely what people are saying about Trump and Epstein.
And well, you and I both have written about the satanic ritual abuse scare in the 1980s and 90s and have also put some of that subgenre of conspiracy theory in historical context, why so many feminists and therapists not only endorsed but circulated these theories. And I think similarly, there was a kind of critique of authority and the concentration of power and wealth. But the conspiracy theory both signaled or registered that, a shift in the culture with children, young, innocent children, and the preying upon young children as kind of the moral center of how this crisis was framed. But at the same time, as you say, it distracts from the actual observable villainy that is a reaction to, yeah.
Well, these theories, you know, they center children, and the belief when you're acting on behalf of children, they're the symbol of purity, they're the symbol of our future, you cannot go wrong. Anything you say, any bit of excess, will be excused because of the nobility of your beginnings and your subject matter.
Right, and even a moral urgency to act.
But how that got conflated with Epstein is a complicated and almost serendipitous mix of abuse and resentment of the Clintons and the Democratic establishment, the Democrats that have moved away from representing working people to representing actually parts of the financial establishment, along with the legal establishment and the series of jobs that have replaced all the manufacturing jobs. The Democrats went after that crowd, leaving behind millions of people that they had reported to and, in fact, had vigorously worked for decades. So you've got...
So there's something correct in the MAGA reaction to the Democrats selling out.
Well, the Democrats definitely sold out, whether you would say their MAGA reaction is correct or not. But you can certainly see that where the energy, the problems, the thrashing around that would lead to focusing in on whatever one could to explain profound change.
Yeah, I think part of the choreography of this and the staging of this particular conspiracy theory about a pedophile trafficking ring and the cover-up of Epstein and all of the liberals and Democrats that MAGA followers believe were at the heart of this conspiracy. I mean, part of how this gets elaborated is through the figure of Trump as the redeemer, as a kind of divinely ordained redeemer who is also going to avenge through exposing the conspiracy, is going to avenge all of the grievances of his followers. So I think the fact that Trump himself is so central to anyone who's been looking, hanging out with this guy, as long as both of them saw each other as their closest best friend, that the overlooking of Trump makes sense in the context of conspiracy theories, because he had to be himself a bad enough guy to enter this world to unlock it and to overthrow it. So I think his alluding to evil forces, I mean, Trump was never big on the details of the conspiracy theory. It was more gesturing toward it or fueling it by these references to dark forces, evildoers, that he's going to not only expose, but avenge.
Well, I think we're serendipitously lucky here, because the whole fervent surge of conspiracy theories was initially centered on Hillary and on the Democrats. And the convictions, as you said, that Trump would swoop down like an avenging angel and take care of him, just overlooked the fact that if you really looked into all of, and Epstein became a figure who was close to Bill Clinton, who they knew Bill Clinton had met, but they had no idea at the time how tight Jeffrey Epstein and Donald Trump were, how many parties they went to together, how many times they were photographed together, and how many little love notes involving naked women Trump would write to Epstein. So this is creating all kinds of cognitive dissonance now, because what's happening is their hero, what's his place here? Is he with us or against us or both or what?
Yeah, and I think part of the impasse around and the difficulty moving past this level of conspiratorial thinking is that there is at the base of conspiracy theories an investment in and an emotional investment in, and a cognitive investment in exposing a hidden truth and the detective work of exposing the hidden truth.
Right.
And so the details connecting all the dots all lead to one big gestalt, one big fiction. But the conspiracy theories also are ways of organizing people politically. And the government historically has used conspiracies of various kinds, like the weapons of mass destruction, you know, and a lot of the promotion, of course, McCarthyism. There are a lot of conspiracies that the government has promoted of hidden evildoers that have to be exposed, that have been central to political campaigns and propaganda. So conspiracy theories are a kind of propaganda, and ones that are very immune to evidence, because the lack of evidence tends to circle back as evidence of the scale and scope of the conspiracy. So the more lack of evidence or disconfirmatory evidence, the greater the suspicion that there are more and more people involved in the cover-up. So there's a circularity to conspiracy theories that makes them hard to dislodge.
And also a congenital allergy to facts in the Trump administration. And facts are regarded as enemies, as foes. If someone presents facts, for example, about the relatively slow job growth in this country, they have to be fired. You don't fix the slow job growth. What you do is you kill the messenger.
Right. All of this, like the much of the evil doing of Epstein, Trump, and their collection of people, much of that is pretty observable and done in daylight. But there's more fascination with what's done in the night.
Yeah, I returning to what I said initially, I think what's striking here is how absolutely revelatory Epstein's behavior is. If anyone wants to take a close look at the functioning of global capitalism and the way in which administrative, legislative, and even judicial decisions are made, you would have to acknowledge the role of people like Epstein and the commodities and currencies they provide and to who they provide them.
Including young women and girls as important currencies, perhaps more importantly in a kind of pre-social infantile way of showing something off, showing off a girl or a young woman rather than a sexual relationship in any socially meaningful way.
Jan, I think sexual relationships as a commodity offering that is something that is known by lobbyists in Sacramento and Washington as a way of reaching certain legislators who cannot otherwise be reached. And you can't persuade everybody on every issue, and some people you can very rarely persuade on anything, but the trafficking of young women and the opportunities offering of sexual favors is a fundamental method of persuasion.
Evil doings, but often of a banal sort, but quite destructive.
What is banal should not be banal. The very fact that this is typical, routine behavior does not mean it should not be a scandalous behavior.
Or exploitive of women.
Yeah, it's very exploitive of women. It creates deception in why votes are made or why administrative decisions are made or why documents like Epstein's are not reviewed. It creates a false discourse if we don't look at all this in the light of what are the actual functionings of global capitalism. And that should not be regarded as a banal thing or a banal thing.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll probably be forced to continue to follow this case. Hopefully it may be the final conspiracy that does some of these people in.
We can certainly hope so.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
Let's open the door and look inside for the file on the state of denial. Hypocrisy is the greatest luxury. Raise the double standard. Hypocrisy is the greatest luxury. Raise the double standard. Hypocrisy is the greatest luxury. Raise the double standard. Hypocrisy is the greatest luxury. Raise the double standard.
That was some of Hypocrisy is the Greatest Luxury by the disposable heroes of Hypocrisy. And before that, The Left and the Law, with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discussing conspiracy theories and how the Epstein case is about the hypocrisies of the luxury class. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. The luxury class does have some alarming plans for responding to our current catastrophes. You have probably heard of, and perhaps have already read, the essay by Naomi Klein and Astra Taylor on the rise of end times fascism, published in April in The Guardian. But just in case you haven't yet, here are some excerpts and summary to get you started. The essay begins with a discussion of the movement for corporate city-states from the billionaires who are championing what they call exit, the principle that those with means have the right to walk away from the obligations of citizenship, especially taxes and burdensome regulation. These billionaires dream of splintering governments and carving up the world into hyper-capitalist, democracy-free havens under the sole control of the supremely wealthy, protected by private mercenaries, serviced by AI robots, and financed by cryptocurrencies. The startup country contingent is clearly foreseeing a future marked by shocks, scarcity, and collapse. To put it bluntly, the most powerful people in the world are preparing for the end of the world, an end they themselves are frenetically accelerating. The governing ideology of the far right in our age of escalating disasters has become a monstrous supremacist survivalism. Today's end times fascists are, Klein and Taylor point out, alive to our era of genuine existential danger, from climate breakdown to nuclear war to skyrocketing inequality and unregulated AI. But contemporary far-right movements are financially and ideologically committed to deepening those threats and lack any credible vision for a hopeful future. Klein and Taylor point to several slightly different groups within the End Times Fascist Alliance. The ultra-wealthy, the MAGA masses, and the Christian nationalists see somewhat different versions of their lifeboat future. For the ultra-wealthy tech oligarchs, the lifeboat might be in feudal-style corporate city-states, or in luxury bunkers in Hawaii, or in digital clouds into which virtual consciousness is uploaded, or in a colony on Mars. For the MAGA masses, there are lower-cost bunkers and stockpiles of gold, guns, and meals ready to eat. And there is the vision of the whole nation as an armed bunker. Such state bunkers are, Klein and Taylor note, brutal in their determination to expel and imprison unwanted humans, even if that requires indefinite confinement in extranational penal colonies, and equally ruthless in their willingness to violently claim the land and resources, water, energy, critical minerals, they deem necessary to weather the coming shocks. For the Christian nationalists, the future is the rapture. Christian Zionists, for instance, see Israel's violence as evidence that the Holy Land is getting closer to the conditions under which the Messiah will return and the faithful will get their celestial kingdom. Not all of these apocalyptic visions are religious, but all share a rejection of this earth, our shared, collective, embodied life world. Klein and Taylor include a wealth of examples, quotations, and details connecting the dots among these groups and their actions and beliefs. They note that these movements build on past visions of eugenics, in which a small subset of humanity would be making decisions about which parts of the whole were worth continuing and which needed to be phased out or terminated. End times fascism is a self-reinforcing downward spiral, they note, pointing out that Trump 2.0's economic project is a Frankenstein's monster of the industries driving all of these threats: fossil fuels, weapons, and resource-ravenous cryptocurrency and AI. And everyone involved in these sectors knows that there is no way to build the artificial mirror world that AI promises without sacrificing this world. These technologies consume too much energy, too many critical minerals, and too much water for the two to coexist in any kind of equilibrium. Recently, the former Google executive Eric Schmidt admitted as much, telling Congress that AI's profound energy needs are projected to triple in the next few years, with much of it coming from fossil fuels because nuclear can't come online fast enough. This planet incinerating level of consumption is necessary, he explained, to enable an intelligence higher than humanity, a digital god rising from the ashes of our relinquished world. To respond to all this, Klein and Taylor argue we need to both face it fully and to propose an alternative vision. Klein and Taylor suggest that the more people understand the extent to which the right has succumbed to the Armageddon complex, the more they will be willing to fight back, realizing that absolutely everything is now on the line. We must help each other face the depth of the depravity that has gripped the hard right in all of our countries. To move forward with focus, we must first understand that we are up against an ideology that has given up not only on the premise and promise of liberal democracy, but on the livability of our shared world, on its beauty, on its people, on our children, on other species. The forces we are up against have made peace with mass death. They are treasonous to this world and its human and non-human inhabitants. Then, Klein and Taylor argue, we must counter their apocalyptic narratives with a far better story about how to survive the hard times ahead without leaving anyone behind. A story capable of draining end times fascism of its gothic power and galvanizing a movement ready to put it all on the line for our collective survival. A story not of escaping, but of staying put and staying faithful to the troubled earthly reality in which we are enmeshed and bound. They emphasize the notion of here-ness, a commitment to the here-ness of this particular ailing planet, to these frail bodies, to the right to live in dignity wherever on the planet we are, even when the inevitable shocks force us to move. Such a future would require its own apocalypse, its own world-ending and revelation, though of a very different sort, because in order to make earthly planetary survival possible, some versions of this world need to end. We have reached a choice point not about whether we are facing apocalypse, but what form it will take. Our task is to build a wide and deep movement strong enough to stop these unhinged traitors, a movement rooted in a steadfast commitment to one another across our many differences and divides, and to this miraculous, singular planet. I've been reading from The Rise of End Times Fascism by Naomi Klein and Astra Taylor, published in April in The Guardian. I recommend you read the whole essay. I don't think that their argument means we do not prepare, but we do not prepare in order to hunker down alone in our bunkers, waving off everyone else. We prepare so we can help each other, and we prepare by connecting with each other. As Margaret Killjoy puts it on her site, Live Like the World is Dying, the goal of being prepared is that by having your own stuff together, you're more able to help others. And gear is less important than skills. Skills are less important than relationships. We prepare by connecting with each other, here, where we are. We prepare for a better and more caring world, a better apocalypse, a better catastrophe, as Andrew Boyd phrases it for his book, I Want a Better Catastrophe. I encourage us all to recognize the magnitude of the dangers we face and that some in power have embraced. I encourage us all to embrace our here-ness through connecting with our neighbors, our unions, or faith groups, or activist groups, or mutual aid groups, and through KABU, your volunteer-powered community radio station that for over 50 years has been serving the Pacific Northwest, right here, with trusted news, life-saving information, inspiring music, and deep community engagement. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michelle. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine. That was some of The End of the World by REM. And before that, I shared some selections from Naomi Klein and Astra Taylor's essay on The Rise of End Times Fascism. I'm Fran Michelle, and you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Next up, I want to share a talk from Solidarity, an independent socialist organization dedicated to forming a broad regrouping of the U.S. left focused on socialism from below. This talk, by Ivan Drury Zarin, was part of a panel discussion on the origins and problems of the anti-migrant panic, which was the culminating event of a reading and discussion series on the same topic. Ivan mentioned some of the readings from that series in this talk about how borders serve to undermine worker solidarity under capitalism.
Capitalism's enduring use for borders, making a case for why socialists need to be concerned with abolishing borders and with the rights of or the power of migrant working class in particular. So myths have grown up around borders on all sides. The far right claims that a globalist agenda seeks to undo borders with free trade, entering the sovereign nation state that they consider the secure castle of Europeans and white Americans. The left has also seen borders as under threat by capitalist globalization, but from the opposite perspective, by an ever-expanding power of U.S. imperial might that undermines the defenses of formerly colonized countries and creates a world of imperial power unmoored from any central geography. By the beginning of the 21st century, with the publication of Hart and Negri's Empire, it was a left axiom that borders were a thing of the past. If not already, then soon. So why has capitalism not already eliminated borders? What's the useful role of borders within the global system of capitalist production? I'm going to argue that borders have become critical instruments of capitalist production because they make wage differentials by encoding globally fragmented and stacked social averages of reproduction through racist nationalism. And I hope I can explain what I mean by that in the next few minutes. To start off, I want to define the term borders and wages. Borders, like nations, do not have a universal character. They have different political meaning for colonizers than for the colonized. Borders of imperialist countries are instruments of global power, maintaining fortresses that drawbridge commodities in and out, while policing which people can gain access to the benefits of imperial sovereignty and under what terms. But for colonized and neo-colonized countries and nations without sovereign control over their territories, borders can be instruments of national defense against imperial invasion, intervention, and capitalist subordination. For the sake of this discussion, I'll be focusing on the role of imperial borders, those that aid in extraction. As for wages, as we know as Marxists, are the price of the commodity of human labor power. Like other commodities, the value of labor power is determined by the amount of human labor power spent producing it. For the sake of wages, that means education, experience, and unlike other commodities, also the cost of its reproduction. The cost of reproduction is based on a social average, the expected minimum requirements of the cost of everyday life and of reproducing the next generation. In Wage Labor and Capital, Marx writes, quote, "The price of labor will be determined by the cost of production, by the labor time necessary to produce this commodity, labor. What then is the cost of the production of labor? It is the cost required for maintaining the worker as a worker and for developing him into a worker." In the Grundrisse, he says, wages must be the amount of resources required to, quote, "replace the production costs of the living labor capacities." In other words, must keep the workers alive as workers. So baseline wages are the average cost of reproduction, but that does not mean that this average is universal. Marx writes in Capital Volume 1, quote, "In the comparison of the wages of different nations, we must therefore take into account all the factors that determine changes in the amount of the value of labor power, the price and the extent of the prime necessaries of life as naturally and historically developed, the cost of training, the laborers, the part played by the labor of women and children, the productiveness of labor, etc. But key for us here is Marx's note about the prime necessaries of life as naturally and historically developed. This is where Marx's critique surpasses LaSalle's iron law of wages, which assumes wages will not rise higher than the bare minimum necessary for human survival. LaSalle's formulation leans on the idea that the requirements for human survival are some immutable biological or true minimum. Marx's formulation that base wages are conditioned by social, historical averages of the conditions for social reproduction in a given society instead allows for class struggle to determine wages, because workers don't fight for higher wages just for the sake of it, but to improve their standards of living, while capitalists counter by squeezing workers to accept lower and lower real wages. But national and racial difference limit the parameters of class struggle. This differentiation occurs in cultural and ideological realms, an occasion where ideological superstructural processes direct the economic substructure or base of society. Hegemonic ideas about racial, national, and cultural difference transmit common sense about average standards of living for different groups. Certainly, these hegemonic ideas are racist, imperialist, and colonial, but that does not mean they're established through a conspiracy of a shadowy cabal from above. Guttural common sense about national difference is developed in the U.S. working class through the experience of competition with other workers, including those overseas, of participating in imperialist wars, and of the cognitive disjuncture developed through the daily helpless witnessing of the starvation of suffering of so many millions around us. So ultimately, borders do lower wages, but not for the reasons people usually say. So long as the labor movement is defined nationally and organized by national labor laws that sets its jurisdiction of activity along national bases, the organized U.S. working class participates in the devaluation of others so divided by the border. In the contemporary world, borders devalue wages for some fractions of the working class by setting asymmetrical standards of living based on race-coded national difference, primarily through the devaluation of everyday standards of living for some groups. A useful example of this is the devaluation of labor power racialized Asian in the early 20th century U.S. and Canada. There was an international system of labor brokers marketing Asian labor as a cheap solution to the problems of the settlement of the West in Canada and westward expansion in the United States. Rather than fight this system, the section of the organized working class that identified itself with British or U.S. empire tended to oppose the importation of workers racialized Asian, using eugenicist arguments that they had an unfair advantage in the labor market, that they had biologically lower caloric needs, and culturally lower expectations of comfort. They formed the Asiatic Exclusion League in 1905 and rioted in San Francisco, Bellingham, and Vancouver, demanding the expulsion and exclusion of Asian workers. These riots had the effect of confirming the subhuman status of Asian workers and therefore lowering the price of their labor power. There's some irony to this because the driver of the anti-Asian riots was the Asiatic Exclusion League conviction that Asian workers would drive down white wages, take the jobs of whites, and buy the properties that whites were supposed to settle. But it was the rise of these beliefs into the status of common sense that erected a border between Asian workers and whites, establishing a different, lower social average of reproductive needs. Rather than seeing lower wages as innate, which is how the Asiatic Exclusion League members saw it, we must see those lower wages as an outcome of their racism, which aligned with the interests of capitalism. Over the past 50 years, the growth of global transportation and communications infrastructure has made possible a truly global labor market. The old contradiction of settler colonial capitalism, we need the workers, we don't need the people, is now resolved by border police. The dehumanization of migrants by border regimes also contributes to their subperson status in labor markets. Since reading the Fitzgerald chapter, The Euro Moat, I've been thinking about his anecdote about Greek fishers finding migrant bodies washed up on shore. When a fisher reported the body he found, his boat was impounded, meaning he could not work, punishing him and his family for treating migrants as human beings. From then on, Greek fishers in that community throw bodies back into the tide, keeping the secrets of Europe's anti-migrant killing seas. I also think about the story told by migrant rights organizer Salvador G. Sarmiento on the Intercepted podcast in June. He said that last year, a 16-year-old worker was crushed to death in a machine in a chicken processing plant in Tennessee. Other workers were afraid to talk to OSHA because they're scared of ICE. In 1900, migrants were dehumanized by their racial status through white supremacist and eugenicist ideas. In 2025, migrants are dehumanized by their behavior as migrants rather than their racialized status, officially and rhetorically at least. But the racist effect of such liberal dehumanization is the same. This means the border is not a single issue. It's always been an instrument used by capital to divide workers by race and nationality and to establish wage differentials on these bases. But workers have also played a role in the making of those differentials by contributing to the definition and consolidation of common sense about race and national difference. The task of socialists in this struggle, which is a field of class struggle, should be obvious. Some factions of workers' movements have ventriloquized capital by demanding that state powers exclude workers whose labor power has been devalued by the border. That was what the AEL did in 1907, and it's what some union leaderships are doing that support Biden and Trump's detention and deportation machinery. These are our people who European border guards are drowning in the Mediterranean Sea, our people who ICE is rounding up into a concentration camp guarded by alligators in a Florida swamp. By fighting to abolish the capitalist state's power of border exclusion, detention, and deportation, we express a politics of international workers' power over the logic of production for a truly universal citizenship. Thank you.
Remember the Garden of Eden before Eve hung out with that snake? You could walk down the street, not worry about thieves. All the kids could go trick-or-treating. Then those foreigners started coming in, like the Germans in 1790. Then the Irish arrived let a pale a shade of white when they say we want our America back, our America back, our America back. When they say we want our America back, well, what the f*** do they mean?
That was some of Jill Sobule singing America Back, and before that, Ivan Drury-Zarin explaining capitalism's enduring use for borders. I'm Fran Michel, and you are listening to the Old Mall Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Finally today, we'll revisit a conversation from 13 years ago between Yasmin Nair and Denise Morris. Yasmin recently included this interview in her archive of work on immigration, noting the failures of current liberal writers to acknowledge the long history of how previous administrations prepared the way for the current nightmare. Here's that conversation on the language of illegal versus undocumented.
This is Denise Morris, and I have Yasmin Nair on the phone with me. Welcome to KBOO, Yasmin.
Thanks, Denise. It's a pleasure to be back here.
Yes, you are a longtime contributor to the Old Mole, but let me tell folks a little bit about who you are before we get started talking about our subject today. You are a Chicago-based writer, activist, academic, and commentator, and your work appears in various anthologies, including Captive Genders, Trans Embodiment and the Prison Industrial Complex, Windy City Queer, Dispatches from the Third Coast, and Arab Studies Quarterly. As well, you are a co-founder and member of the editorial collective Against Equality. You've contributed to Against Equality anthologies, Queer Critiques of Gay Marriage, and Don't Ask to Fight Their Wars, as well the anthology Prisons Will Not Protect You. And your activism includes immigration work, public education, gentrification, and youth at risk. You are busy, and we thank you for taking some time to talk with us this morning.
Thank you.
So, undocumented versus illegal, this is the subject of your new article examining immigration rights movements in the U.S. Most notable of late is the emergence in the last few years of the grassroots youth movement, Undocumented and Unafraid. And in this article, you look at the campaigns to end the use of the word illegal, putting undocumented in its place. The argument being, of course, that illegal is stigmatized and undocumented confers more dignity. But you argue, actually, that, quote, this is a distinction without a difference. Using one word instead of another does nothing to erase the harsh realities faced by those living without papers in this country. So to begin, Yasmin, let's have you describe briefly what has been the political and strategic direction for the immigration rights movement following the mass protests that erupted in 2006.
Sure. I think one of the most notable features about the immigration rights movement is its sort of gradual movement away from looking at immigration as a crisis around labor issues and instead moving into a very sort of affective realm instead. So over the last 6 odd years, the immigration rights movement has preferred to dwell upon the issue of families torn apart and so on. It's been a very personalized discourse. I think the strategy they decided upon was one that centralized people as opposed to policies. I think they thought that this would help push some form of immigration reform forward. And in fact, I think I would argue, as I do in my pieces, that this has been actually disastrous for the immigration rights movement. It's done the opposite. It's created far more grueling conditions for a certain subset of people.
And we'll talk about that later in the segment, but I wanted to first have you address this question of undocumented versus illegal. Why does this emerge? You know, my sense as someone who's, you know, a fairly aware person trying to do activism as well, that my sense has been that this movement was actually somewhat a corrective to the dream activism, more civil disobedient, more visibility, perhaps risky, and somewhat creative.
Mm-hmm. It's not quite so much a corrective, but actually a response alongside dream activism. What happened in 2006 is that we saw the emergence of a new young generation of people who were growing up, who had just graduated high school or who were just entering college and realizing that they had absolutely no rights under the current laws. And I think this sparked, especially in Chicago, there was a movement around one young immigrant named Rigo Padilla. I was involved in that particular case. Essentially, I think that the undocumented, unafraid movement began as a really vital, important, and very dynamic grassroots movement. It has since become something that's been swallowed up by mainstream immigration rights organizations.
So then, to detail that out a bit, you talk about the relationship that a lot of this mainstream activism, we see this in the gay mainstream movements as well, turning towards a system that is understood to be somewhat neutral as the arbiter of fairness to achieve certain goals. You put this in a different context, looking at neoliberalism and the prison industrial complex, and this construct of good immigrant, bad immigrant.
Right. And we saw this, you know, starting in 2006, there was an effort within the immigration rights movement, and especially the DREAM activists, to constantly cordon themselves off, to separate themselves away from the bad immigrants, you know, in other words, the high school dropouts, the drug dealers, and so on. So that distinction became really important for them to gain entrance into, as you rightly point out, what the gay movement and what the immigration rights movement construes as a kind of, you know, dispassionate system of governance, when in fact the system of governance that they depend upon, it sort of draws upon notions of legality and illegality that are often tenuous and often quite arbitrary, right? So when you talk about distinguishing, for instance, you know, the drug-dealing immigrant from the good immigrant who comes here to set up a home for his family, when you make those kinds of distinctions, you ignore the fact that the drug wars, the NAFTA-induced drug wars and the trade wars have in fact created entire classes of people who have to resort to what are then construed as forms of illegality or ways of making a living that are construed as illegal. But all of that is a result of the very policies, right, that are very artificially imposed upon various countries by the United States. So I think there's a way in which both the gay rights movement, you know, when it looks for equality, for instance, or the immigration rights movement, when it looks for imbuing itself with this idea of being good or more legal than others, I think both segments ignore the fact that the notion of legality itself is a profoundly neoliberal construct.
Obama quoted, you quoted him in your piece, had this to say, quote, "If we're going to go after folks who are here illegally, we should do it smartly and go after folks who are criminals, gangbangers, people who are hurting the community, not after students, not after folks who are here just because they're trying to figure out how to feed their families." This distinction is being made, of course, on the grassroots as well as by policymakers.
Right.
So then you point out as well this important question about what gets lost in some of this activism when we have constructs in which we have more legal or less legal, good versus bad, that the whole system of legality doesn't get talked about. It becomes almost invisible.
Right.
So talk a little bit about that. What is it? What would it look like to have a critique of a system of legality?
Right. Right. I think I just also wanted to emphasize that when he talks about gangbangers and when immigrants talk about the illegals, they're also ignoring the fact that this country has 5% of the world's population and 25% of the prison population, and that most people in jail today are African Americans and people of color. So there's also that. I just want to point that out as well, in the ways that the immigration rights movement also ignores the kind of systemic inequalities perpetuated by the prison industrial complex and by phrases like gangbangers. But in terms of, I guess you're asking about, you know, what would it look like, right? You're asking, I think, is what would it look like to resist this? That work is actually being done by several young activists in Chicago who are, in fact, many of them have been determined as quote-unquote illegal, have, you know, they're not called undocumented, they're the ones called illegal, they are being deported, but are also doing a lot of really amazing work against the prison industrial complex and against neoliberalism. For instance, last year, right before a giant immigration rights rally, a number of them, some of whom actually had the surveillance bracelets on their ankles, actually showed up at the Boeing factory, to protest the U.S. war machine before they went to the immigration rights rally. And in many ways, a lot of these people are actually doing very on-the-ground activism against the prison industrial complex, for instance, and refusing. I know a number of young activists, for instance, who are refusing to buy into this distinction between the good and the bad immigrants, and who also, this is also, I think, very important to remember, is that the other way to resist this is to resist something like the DREAM Act, and particularly the DREAM Act's dependence upon the military. One of the big elements of the DREAM Act is this idea that youth especially should have the option, quote-unquote, of going into the military in order to gain an eventual pathway to citizenship. And there are actually youth, undocumented illegal youth, who are resisting the DREAM Act. So that kind of work does not get spoken about in the mainstream media. And I think the way to start to resist and to actually create a discourse and an action around immigration is to first, I think, start asking really hard questions. And also, you know, in the spirit of AIDS activism from the 80s and 90s, to refuse to buy into those distinctions. You know, in the 90s, people in South Africa were wearing T-shirts that said, I am HIV positive. You know, in other words, to sort of take on the burden of AIDS and to refuse to differentiate between themselves and those who were HIV positive. And I've often wondered if that, what would it look like for us to do the same thing as immigration rights activists, to refuse to buy into those distinctions.
It is important to clarify for folks that this is certainly not just a concern about language or identity, although identity plays into how political strategies are enacted. And really at the core here is our concerns about political action and the broader social justice ends we struggle for. And the challenge, I think, to the left to speak up for those who end up being more marginalized mm-hmm. within marginalized groups. And this is often a difficult struggle when movements right. are being built. Why don't we finish then with this question about identity? I want to quote you real quickly and then have you just take the last couple minutes. You say, when immigration becomes a declarative identity, then we have no system to fight. And I tend to think of this in terms of the system being naturalized and understood as this neutral entity rather than something that really actually has fangs. And folks see it as a way for individuals to kind of pass through freely, except for those few obstacles mm-hmm. here and there that aren't necessarily understood as systemic. So my question for you is to quote you again, that you talk about these groups are targeted groups because of the color of their skin, regardless of any legislation that might go through SB 1070 mm-hmm. passing in Arizona. So my question for you is, as an activist working on these issues, particularly with young people, what does it look like to try to come to consciousness that there is a system to fight?
I think what that looks like is, I don't want to sound unhopeful, but I think there's a lot of work ahead of us because the sort of conversation around illegality and immigration is already being predetermined by enormously powerful immigration rights groups. But I think there is already that consciousness within youths that I know of and adults that I already know. And even in the left, a lot of people understand this. But I think they've bought into this notion of undocumented is better than illegal precisely because so many of the activists working on that are in fact themselves self-identified as progressive or left.
I really appreciate you coming on the program, and we'll continue to discuss these issues going forward. And we'll link
Thank
to
you
your
so
website and to your piece, Yasmin Nair. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
The Guineas, the Coolies, the Wetbacks, the Reds, the Jews, now those terrorists. And who let in the woman looks after my kids and the one who is cleaning my mess. Life was righteous, life was clean. Send them all back, including me, when they say,
sent them all back, including me. That was some more of Jill Sobule's America Back, And before that, an archive conversation between Old Mole Denise Morris and writer-activist Yasmin Nair about illegal versus undocumented as a distinction without a difference. I'm Fran Michel, and I've been your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. We'll link to more of Yasmin Nair's writing on immigration and more information about all the segments on today's episode online at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. While you're there, you can send us a message, subscribe to our show, share it with others, and click on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner to help support local independent media. Thanks to everyone who contributed to today's show. Thanks to Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, Ivan Drury-Zarin and all the folks at Solidarity, Yasmin Nair and Denise Morris and all the moles. Thank you to all of KBOO's listeners, members, volunteers, and staff. If you value having this station that embodies and promotes the values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change, please give to KBOO. You can support KBOO by becoming a member, making a one-time donation, or becoming a monthly sustaining member. On the website at kboo.fm or on the mobile app, you can click on the red Donate tab to help support local independent media. Or you can support KBOO by texting KBOO to 44321 or by snail mailing your support to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Stay tuned for Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with more of Hypocrisy is the Greatest Luxury by the Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy.
Opportunism can turn the politics into cartoonism. Let's not patronize or criticize. Let's open the door and look inside. Pull the file on the state of denial. Hypocrisy is the greatest luxury. Raise the double standard. Hypocrisy.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO's fall membership drive is just around the corner. Help us kick off our KBOO Out Loud Drive on August 20th for National Radio Day, where we'll